You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 17th to the 23rd of October 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy features editor Paul Jump and reporter Elizabeth Gibney. Lizzie, I believe it's the last time you'll join us before you move on to Pastures New. Where are you headed?
That's right, I'm off to Nature, so I'm going to be a physics reporter there. So a little bit of a change of scene, but sad to be leaving also.
Of course, I would hope so. Good luck. But before you do go, you'll be filling us in a bit later on the report by Sir Andrew Whitty. That's coming up later. Before that, we'll cover pay ratios in UK higher education, as a report finds that pay in the sector is a bit more unequal than previously thought. And we'll hear from Paul, who's been finding about how the assessment of university research has evolved over the years. There's always a good chance the REF will be on the agenda if Paul's joining us, and that's the case today. But first, the splash. Simon, we should come to you. It's written by David Matthews. He's not with us, but I'm sure you can fill us in. What's it all about?
Well, basically, it's a report that's been done by the Young Greens, kind of youth branch of the Green Party, and they've done a sort of mass FOI, Freedom of Information, request to all universities in the country. They got back responses from 113, in fact, asking them about the sort of lowest paid employees and the highest paid. And, you know, it's got some interesting results. They've sort of looked at the ratio between highest and lowest paid in across the sector, found the average is actually almost 19 to 1 across the whole sector. Which is, and it's come a very well-timed week, really, because the UCU, Unison and Unite actually announced a sort of first national joint strike between them since they were formed. I mean, obviously, those unions aren't that old, but they're actually going to hold a national strike on pay on the 31st of October after receiving another 1% offer this year, and they feel sort of the below inflation offers the last few years. I mean, they've taken enough of a real terms pay cut now. But this report is quite interesting.
Nice of them to reveal that strike just after our press deadline, of course. But good opportunity to get it in there.
Yeah, although I mean there is a mention in the front of the magazine about the fact that they were finalising the date. Mm. So, we were well aware that was about to happen. But, it did happen just after we went to press. But this report, it's very interesting. It comes in this week because it shows that if you compare the university sector with areas of the public sector, local authorities, for instance, I mean, the pay ratio does appear to be far higher. It doesn't compare very well also with a 2008 figure of 15 to 1 being the ratio between highest and lowest paid, although it should be said that that was based on taking the lowest paid as the lowest paid in the sort of pay spine for academics or for workers in universities. So it may not have included the lowest paid in universities. So
does this include sort of outsourced workers as well, because obviously a lot of universities these days outsource a lot of services to other companies. Is that taken into account?
Well, I suppose what's interesting is on this survey that the Young Greens have done is that the figures on outsourcing or how much outsourced staff are paid, do not seem to be sort of readily available. So I mean, there seems to be some missing data there, really, on those particular members of staff. Universities don't seem to know exactly how much those outsourced staff are being paid, and the argument would be that they aren't getting the terms and conditions that the staff directly employed by the universities are getting.
I think there's increasing pressure on that though as well. A recent talk by Michael Arthur, the new VC at UCL the other day, that was a question was about outsourcing and staff, and they said that they've made sure that the London Living Wage is paid, including to staff who are outsourced. So
it's okay when people talk about it, isn't it? Because they are going to say things like that. I suppose what Simon's saying there is it's more concerning that people are either don't have this data or they're just not prepared to go on the record and say it, because that suggests an unhappier story than the one maybe UCL tells.
I imagine.
I mean, what the actual report found was that only a small handful of universities knew how many outsourced employees were paid below the living wage, basically. I mean, the main sort of point of the report was to argue that universities should be paying a living wage to all employees, really, and which is £7.45 an hour, basically, and £8.55 in London. So that's the kind of that's the argument, is that some universities have already pledged to do this, but very, very small fraction of them.
Yeah, indeed. And do read that piece. It's on page 6. There's a top 10 of universities with the highest to lowest salary ratios, which is worth looking at too. But yeah, we'll whet your appetite by flagging that up, but not tell you who's at the top. Moving on, Paul, you've got the cover feature this week. It's all about how research assessment has changed over the years. Who have you been speaking to, and what's the picture really?
Yeah, well, essentially it's about the history of the REE, which came in 2006. It was invented by former Cambridge Vice Chancellor Peter Swinnerton Dyer.
Who, you say 2006?
Sorry, did I say that? Sorry, 1986. Peter Swinnerton Dyer is still around. He's 86 now, but he's still very much on the ball. So I interviewed him about, you know, what his aspirations for it were and what he made of what it had become. I also spoke to a couple of the people who in the interim had sort of overseen the growth of the REE. I mean, certainly in 86 it was a very small scale affair. Each department was only required to submit 5 outputs in total, plus 4 pages of general description. Anything longer than that was pulped. And that was your lot, really.
Stuff of dreams are made of, isn't it?
Well, yes, arguably, but then again, you know, people were very unhappy with that initial exercise. At least some people were. Universities thought that they weren't being given sufficient opportunity to sort of demonstrate their, you know, research strengths. They wanted to be able to submit more. There was also, in subsequent REEs, there was a concern that universities that lost out in the REE might challenge the panel's decisions if it wasn't made much more rigorous. So hence all the elaborate rules came in about who you have to submit, how the panels have to operate, all that stuff. So all that bureaucracy sort of came in sort of largely at the behest of universities, really, or partly at the fear of what universities would do, you know, if the exercise wasn't seen to be rigorous. So in a way, you know, the universities that complain about the amount of bureaucracy that there is, you know, in some ways you could say they've only got themselves to blame.
And what did Swinnerton Dyer say when you asked him about the REF as it currently stands? What did he...
Yeah, deeply unimpressed, basically. He thinks that his methodology, you know, though clearly it wasn't particularly fine-grained or anything, his point is it was perfectly sufficient to get the pecking order roughly right at departmental level, and he thinks that all the subsequent elaboration really doesn't add much in terms of that. I mean, if you look at how the sort of league tables fluctuate over the years, that would seem to bear out to some extent his contention. You know, universities tend not to move up and down particularly dramatically. So, you know, you could argue that if that's all you want to do, you just get a sort of rough idea of who's good and who isn't, that would be sufficient.
I think we can say that a lot of academics would agree with him as well. In fact, the graphic that we've got this week on page 9 shows some of the opinions from the UCU survey that Paul, you reported on a few weeks ago. And I think 60% of those who were spoken to thought that the REE had had a detrimental impact on higher education. So.
Yes, yeah. I mean, all the architects of the exercise over the years certainly would disagree with that. I mean, they all think there's absolutely no doubt that the REE has increased the quality of UK research. The problem is that, you know, arguably it's put too much focus on research and not enough on teaching. Mm. And that's the regret that quite a few of them have.
Indeed. Well, sticking with the RAF to an extent, a report by Sir Andrew Whitty, Chief Executive of GlaxoSmithKline, which was out this week, said that impact should be given a weighting of 25% at the next RAF. We covered that bit online, Lizzie. You've looked at this report in a bit more detail for the magazine. What else was in there?
Well, yes, so he came up with a number of concrete suggestions, which is quite nice to see, because sometimes these reports can be quite wishy-washy. And, you know, he pulled out the obvious that universities are a great strength for the UK. We should be harnessing them more for growth. And so a few of the ways that he said that we should be doing that included, for instance, increasing the amount of money that goes into the Higher Education Innovation Fund. So he wanted to put an extra $90 million a year into that, which I imagine would be quite welcomed within the sector. He also thought that an idea actually we wrote about in a different context of having a kind of help desk for people from the outside to come to within the university. He calls it a triage, so that businesses, especially small businesses, could come to universities and find the best people to talk to help them out. So there are a few little ideas like that, and among them were this one to put up the percentage the impact represents within the REF to 25%. That was quite a small part of the overall report. It was a couple of lines compared to quite a mammoth thing overall. So I think it was one of the more eye-catching actual suggestions, and probably that will get most people talking. But his main thrust was around getting more streamlining, not focusing on geography, not letting geographical lines stop people working together when they are actually all the best in a particular field. Mm. So perhaps in some way going against some of the regional development policies that we've seen, especially from the previous government. But yeah, I asked him, why will this work when so many other efforts haven't really in the past? Again, you know, we know universities could be a great resource, but not really tapping into them. And he said, well, actually, a lot of people are. A lot of different things are working really well on different levels. And if we apply those to, you know, say 25 universities in 25 places rather than just 3, 4, or 5, then it could have a big effect. So it was received quite positively, but
like you say, a lot of people have said that before, haven't they? They're kind of, you know, trying to dilute the where this money goes is a difficult task to meet.
Absolutely, he also wants more money for it, but it's not clear whether that would actually be just redirected money. He thinks his idea is to have arrow projects, kind of starting from a technology university and then like flowing out into the local businesses and supply chains and. Yes, he thinks that should get a billion pounds over the next parliament. But
no. And all of this money is coming from the taxpayer, presumably. I mean, has he addressed the fact that, you know, by international comparisons, British businesses just aren't investing enough in R&D?
That wasn't explicitly addressed, but I think the assumption is that if the collaboration was there, then the businesses would see the advantages and that would be putting more money in themselves. But yeah, the £1 billion was in government money, and he does seem to think the government has quite a big role. They're the ones who should be assessing and targeting these which technologies are going to be the areas of growth and lining all the ducks up in a row, really, to make sure that this actually happens as a streamlined process. So again, it's a classic wait and see, I think.
Absolutely. Before we go, I will flag up one of my pieces, which I don't usually do, but we've quite a bit on MOOCs this week, including one item which brings together four of the sort of original MOOCers. So Stephen Downes and George Siemens came up with the first ever MOOC over in Canada about 5 years ago, I think it was. A lot of people think that the MOOC term arrived in the last 18 months or so. Well, it didn't. It's a good 5 years old and was coined by Dave Cormier and Brian Alexander. And for this piece, I managed to, one of the subs phrased it as bring the band back together and speak to them all about what they think has happened to the MOOC that they created in the following 5 years. So do have a read of that too. And if you want to comment on any of the stories we've discussed today, or indeed anything else in the magazine, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can find us on LinkedIn, on Facebook, you'll find us on Twitter and on Google+, all the usual places. So please do get in touch. But that's all from this week's Times Higher Education issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.